Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Not many Americans know the story of the mine wars that were fought between workers, labor unions, and mine company guards during the early 1900s. Today, we'll talk with filmmaker Randy McLowry, whose PBS documentary, The Mine Wars, focuses on these armed uprisings by labor organizers in the coalfields of southern West Virginia.
These were men that found themselves in a situation where they were had been denied their basic rights as American citizens.
And we'll hear from people down in southern West Virginia who say they're proud to see the history of the Mine Wars getting more attention through a Mine Wars museum that opened several years ago.
I think that we have a lot to say, and I think we're going to say it. We're going to tell our history, and we're going to come together as a community.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On our show today, we'll talk about a sensitive topic in our region, the Mine Wars. It's an important episode because there aren't many people who know about West Virginia's bloody labor history, even here in Appalachia, let alone around the country. The shootouts between organizing miners and hired guns for the coal bosses went on for decades around the turn of the 20th century. Many people died on both sides of the struggle. Labor history is deeply rooted to West Virginia's past, and though some union supporters wonder what will happen to the unions in the Mountain State in the future, we wanted to look back at a story that's just not very well known here in the state or across the country. We've talked a lot on this show about who gets to tell Appalachia's story, and this can get kind of touchy because, well, we've been burned before. And while learning about the Mine Wars, I found that even during our struggle for dignity and constitutional rights, the national media was quick to dismiss what they called an uncivilized group of Appalachian people. On this show, we hope to look deeper into the origins of these stereotypes. West Virginia historian Chuck Keeney says many of the national perceptions of us Appalachians may have started during the Mine Wars, and these stereotypes continue to this day.
All of these things that happened, the media and the powers that be explained away these violent incidents by saying that this violence was the result of a backward, isolated, feuding, moonshine-driven mountain culture. And to say that the violence was inherent in the culture and their backwardness and they were in the way of progress, it was a way of explaining the violence without delving into the real causes. And so the stereotypes that became associated with Appalachia go back to that.
So why were coal miners fighting? A new PBS documentary says they were fighting for basic constitutional rights and freedoms.
These were men that were found themselves in a situation where they were had been denied their basic rights as American citizens.
That's Randy McLowry. He's the producer and director of the new documentary called The Mine Wars. The documentary says they felt the government had promised them rights like the right of free assembly and the right to free speech, but failed to deliver. In the early 1900s, they were frustrated with poor working conditions and the harsh control that the coal operators kept over workers. Miners were paid in scrip that could only be used in company-owned stores, so the miners fought back against the company bosses, who were trying to prevent them from joining the United Mine Workers Union. They wanted a shorter workday, and they wanted to put a stop to child labor. Yes, in those days, it was normal even for children to work long 12-hour shifts down in the mines. Randy McLowry recently chatted with me about this episode of American Experience, a history program on PBS. The documentary opens with scenes inside a coal mine. We see several coal miners, one squeezing against the wall into a pocket in the rib of the mine as a buggy passes. We also see miners lighting cigarettes underground from the flames on their helmets. And we hear about those struggles in the opening of the show. Historian Ronald Lewis explains society's take on the coal miner.
In most cultures where there are coal miners, middle-class people and above think they're animals, literally, and treat them that way. And they know that. So what they do is reverse that matter, and they take pride in the fact that they can actually survive in such a place. And it makes them hard, and they stand on their own. and they don't care what the public thinks.
I think it's interesting that there really aren't many people who know about this history, whether it be here in the coal fields or beyond. The story begins with an introduction to Mary Harris Jones, known as Mother Jones. Mother Jones was once called the most dangerous woman in America by a United States district attorney. She was working to organize the miners, and as we see in this documentary, these Americans had to fight for basic civil rights of fair treatment. The story is about the time which the companies controlled basically every detail of the miners' lives, where they worked, where they shopped, and even where they lived. The ones who fought back and wanted to join the union were kicked out of company-owned homes and wound up living in tents. Let's check out a clip that really helps to paint a picture of what these striking miners went through. We'll hear from the narrator, then historian John Williams, then from a historian from West Virginia, Chuck Keeney.
At Christmas time, 1912, as the strike headed into its eighth month, Mother Jones made a visit to the camps in southern West Virginia, delivering shoes, clothes, and presents for children. Frank and Bessie Keeney and their four children rang in the new year in a tent.
The situation in the tent colonies would have been dispiriting, but at the same time, if you invested that much time in it, then your stubbornness probably was as important as your weariness.
Frank Keeney had a book of poems, and he kept it with him in his tent during the Paint Creek, Cabin Creek strike. And it was something that he turned to in probably some of the very dark moments of the strike. Keeney said to the miners, "One day there will be no more tent colonies, no more gunmen, because of what you people are going through right now."
Such powerful images of snow falling at the beginning of that scene, and Mother Jones holding a child in her arms as we hear the narrator tell us she was delivering shoes to the children. The last person was Chuck Keeney talking about his great-grandfather, Frank Keeney. It seemed to show that there was a lot at stake here. Striking miners and their families were living out of tents. What do you think that says about their spirit, Randy?
I want to point out that it wasn't just men, but it was men, women, and children that were living in these tent colonies. And they had to make very hard choices to go out on strike. When they went out on strike, it was they couldn't stay in their homes, so they got kicked out of their homes and found themselves living, as you said, in tents. And so, and it wasn't just for a week or 2 weeks. They were there for months on end. And that scene you just talked about, you know, snowing and cold and dealing with insanitary conditions, and there were women who were having babies in these tent colonies, and dealing with sickness and so on. And so there was a real dedication to their desire to create a better life for themselves and what they believed was a better life that they deserved as miners, and were fighting for, you know, having safer working conditions and having, you know, the a more equitable in terms of their wages and so on, and not having to deal with things like, you know, doing what they call the long ton, where they were having to dig 2,400 pounds of coal and getting paid for just 2,000 pounds. So there were a lot of injustices that they were fighting. And, you know, they did have help from the UMW in these tent colonies and providing supplies and food and things like that. But it really was, you know, they were on the front lines of this strike, and it took great courage and great dedication to really withstand that and to feel like what they were doing was going to make a difference.
We talked before about how they were living in tents, and along with dealing with those kind of conditions with limited supplies, you know, the coal companies weren't going to let the union rise without a fight, so they hired armed guards from a private police force called the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency, and the miners often referred to them as Baldwin Felts thugs. The documentary mentions that company owners said the profit margins were too low to support the union's demands. So along with private police force, company owners also sent in strike breakers, or what the union would call scabs. In this next clip, we hear the narrator as we see passenger trains carrying newly hired men traveling into the mountains.
Mine owners embarked on a vigorous campaign to import strikebreakers from New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, and the Deep South. Transportation men, as they were called, poured into the area on armed trains, often under the protection of National Guardsmen. Strikers and their wives were often waiting to confront the transportation men when they disembarked at depots near Paint Creek and Cabin Creek. My Aunt Nellie stomped a strikebreaker in the face with her high heels and tore his ears loose and knocked his teeth out, just about killed him, one woman remembered. She was just a little thing and pregnant, but she could fight and cuss good enough to be a man.
The women involved in labor strife, they have everything at stake. The survival of their families is at stake. They're going to be the ones who provide much of the support network to keep the strike going. Oftentimes, standing up to company guards, my grandmother and my mother, they would say there's nothing more vicious than a woman on the strike line.
Usually the women would gather outside the mine in mass and try to keep the scabs from going in. Armed not with guns, but with household utensils.
These images in this part of the story really struck me. Historian Paul Rakes describes the viciousness of women, and the look in their eyes as they hang out of those windows is just fierce. I think it's interesting that you chose to include the women's role in this documentary. So often this story is only about men. How important was the women's role in the strike?
The women's role in the strike was very important. They were down there in the 10 colonies on the front lines with the men. And when the strike breakers came, they were confronting them. They were involved with, shooting at trains with the strike breakers coming in and trying to tear up and rail lines. But they were also there as part of a representation of solidarity, too, in these tent camps. And, they were integral to the struggle and the success of these struggles. And you obviously, you have somebody like Mother Jones, who's a real example of the power of a powerful woman who's participating in a very specific and a very effective way in these strikes and encouraging these strikes and encouraging the men and the women to fight for their rights. And she's a great inspiration to the men. And I would say also for the women as well to stand up for their rights. I mean, she talks about, if I'm here, I am an old lady. If I can stand up and fight, then you should be able to, too. And you need to participate in reaping the rewards of your labor, and you're not doing that. And so she was very effective and very an important part of this.
In our show today, we're talking about a sensitive topic in our region, the mine wars, and a new documentary depicting what the filmmakers are calling the suppressed labor history. The show ends after the Battle of Blair Mountain, when Union sympathizers marched to fight hired police for the right to organize. Randy, could you tell us a bit about how the federal troops were involved in the Battle of Blair Mountain?
They were brought in to assess, how bad things were getting. General Bandholtz, one of the characters in the film, he comes in and he tries to basically get the leaders of the Frank Keeney, who was the president of the District 17 in southern West Virginia, to convince the miners to turn around. And, he attempts to do that and they feel like, well, this has worked. So the federal troops are kind of waiting to see if in fact this sort of subsides. But when in fact it looks like it's really gone into a full war, kind of a firefight and full-scale warfare, they just determined that, the only recourse is for them to send in the troops. And sending in the federal troops really is what, convinces the armed miners that they weren't going to fight against their own country. And there was a decision to lay down their arms. And so the troops came in and they really pretty much put a stop to the fighting. The West Virginia State Police was involved, and they were actually involved in fighting against the armed miners. But in terms of the federal troops, they were there in essence as trying to be a peacekeeping force and to stop the outbreak of the fighting, in which they did. And there was hopes that this would make some changes in the situation in West Virginia by the coal miners in terms of getting rid of the mine guard system. But you know, the troops came in and pretty much they stopped the violence and stopped the fighting, but it didn't change a whole lot in terms of the conditions for the miners.
The documentary also talks a little about how the national media covered the mine wars. This part of the story was really quite eye-opening to me. In this next clip, the narrator and historian Rebecca Bailey share some of those reports.
The murder of Sid Hatfield brought increased attention to the West Virginia Mountaineers. Little of it good.
The New York Times stated that Sid Hatfield had died as he lived, like most of his people lived. Primitive mountaineers essentially live by the sword and die by the sword. And that there would not be peace in the coal fields until these people had all died off. There was no sympathy or empathy for what the miners were enduring.
You have people regarding these folks in Appalachia as subjects of condescension and dismissal, even condemnation. These people may look like Americans, they may have been born in America, but they're not civilized yet.
That was historian and labor activist James Green, the author of The Devil in These Hills. Those are some powerful words: condescension, dismissal. This was the way that the national media portrayed this conflict that when it happened in West Virginia. What do you think that says about perhaps the attitude towards West Virginia at this time? Do you think there's any truth to the way that the perception was, or, you know, the way that they were treated?
Certainly in West Virginia, there were stereotypes and very harsh stereotypes, you know, often what getting associated with sort of Appalachia and with mountaineers. And, you know, this notion in the New York Times editorial calling them primitive mountaineers, and that there was this, and this was built up through popular culture. And there was a, you know, also fed off of things like the Hatfield-McCoy feud and that happened in that same area along the Tug River in southern West Virginia, where there was a presentation of the people in Appalachia and certainly in southern West Virginia as being these people that kind of lived in this backwards existence, and that in some ways they could be dismissed. And looking at what was happening down in West Virginia is, oh, well, it's just all these violent folk down there, and that's just the way they are. And, you know, that stereotype still exists, and I think West Virginia still fights with dealing with these stereotypes today. So, so that definitely played a role in how the public viewed what was happening in West Virginia in terms of aligning some of the violence that was happening with this stereotype about what they were sort of doing, this broad swath of how this community lived in this part of the country, and not understanding the realities of what they were fighting for or the realities of what their conditions were. There were certainly were news reports out there and there were journalists that were reporting on these things, the coal towns and what was happening. But I think that there was a sense that you could sort of, there wasn't a lot of this, as, you know, I think Rebecca Bailey does say, there wasn't a lot of sympathy, you know, or empathy, you know, for what the miners were enduring down there. So that aspect of it, I think, does generate out of these stereotypes that were quite prevalent at that time.
I guess because there was violence. As we saw in the documentary, there was a corrupt government. You know, they were working for coal companies that created these kinds of conditions, and they didn't find any support in trying to go to their government because they were also in support of the coal companies. Did they have any other options than to perhaps resort to violence and pick up arms and stand up? I think there was a quote actually in the documentary that said you had two choices: one, keep your head down and do what the coal companies tell you, or stand up and fight. Do you think they had any other options?
They tried a lot of things. They did. There were efforts to get changes on in terms of appealing to the government and things like that, and they weren't very successful. So I think they did get to the point where they felt like that the government wasn't able to provide them the protections that they, or at least the state government, wasn't able to provide them the protections they felt they deserved, and that even in terms of safety and things like that, that there was very little teeth to the any sort of safety laws that were even in place in West Virginia. So there was a real sense that they really had to stand on their own. And they were being put in a situation where they were, you know, as one of the interviewees says, that this was almost like an industrial police state. And you did have these, the mine guard system, where primarily it was the Baldwin Felts agents that were basically living in the town and they were controlling the town. And you had, if things got out of, you know, if anybody kind of stepped out of line, they would be put in their place. And they also had one of the things that really was very a real contentious for them was that they actually would put spies into the mines and into the coal towns, and you know, to be reporting back on somebody that might have been talking about the union. Their mail was confiscated and looked at. So they were really under the thumb of these coal operators, and you know, the coal operators brought weaponry against them, and there was a point where they felt like they had to turn. They had no other choices but to turn on to turn to violence themselves as a way to fight back. And they did that numerous times as part of the process, and it blew up into these several instances of fairly large moments of bloody conflict.
Hmm. What do you think was different about the labor movement in West Virginia as the labor movement was happening across the country? What was different in West Virginia?
Well, I mean, one of the main things about Southern West Virginia, I think, that was different is that the company towns, and they were much more prevalent in West Virginia and Southern West Virginia than they were in other coal fields throughout the country, and particularly the northern coal fields in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. That part of Southern West Virginia was opened up when the railroads opened up for industrialization and coal mining when the railroads came through. And there wasn't really an infrastructure down there, so the coal operators had to build their own towns and were building all the facilities for supporting this industry. And they then had a much greater control over the lives and the work of the men and the women in these company towns. And I think that control that was in some ways, it was certainly much more prevalent in Southern West Virginia, led to, I think, the greater resistance that then came out on both sides, you know. And I think that there was, you know, and the coal operators in Southern West Virginia, you know, they had this sense that they were living on this razor-thin margin and that they were further away from the markets and they had higher transportation costs, and they were sort of at the mercy of these other forces that they couldn't control, and all that they could control was the laborers and the cost of wages and so on. And so they really sort of created a strategy in their mind to maintain that, and that led to, you know, these instances of very significant conflict and violent conflict.
You mentioned the infrastructure that the coal company set up. There's a lot of communities here in Southern West Virginia that still depend on the infrastructure, especially for water systems that the coal company set up 80 and 90 years ago. But I want to move on. I know some of the folks in Southern West Virginia who are related to Sid Hatfield, the sheriff who helped union miners, and they don't want to talk about their heritage either. Sometimes they're actually embarrassed. I don't remember learning about the mine wars in school either, and it seems like a lot of people here aren't aware of what happened. What do you think accounts for that? Is it because coal companies still have a lot of say in what goes on in West Virginia, or maybe it's something to do with the way the national media covered it way back when? Or, you know, we don't want to think of ourselves as primitive and savage, but the way you tell the story, it seems more like something we could be proud of.
Well, I think West Virginians should be very proud of, you know, their history and proud of this history during this time. As we talked about earlier, I mean, the courage and the dignity of the men and women that fought in the mine wars is quite remarkable. You had, you know, men that were being charged with treason against the state, and you had men that were being, you know, for their actions. And this was something that I think families didn't want to admit or talk about. And so there was an effort, I think, on a personal level to sort of distance themselves from it. And certainly, you know, there was an effort on, you know, state level to push away this history and, you know, to not include it in curriculum. So a number of times in talking to people from West Virginia, they said, I never learned about this in school. And I can't speak to what currently is being taught there. I mean, hopefully this is part of their curriculum or part of what they learn about their state's history, because it's an important and a significant and certainly a very, I would say, a history that one should embrace and be proud of.
There is a new class that's helping to teach teachers about the history of these mine wards, and we'll talk a little bit about that later in the show. Randy, you interviewed some local folks for this documentary. Chuck Keeney's great-grandfather is said to have played a key role in the efforts to unionize. I also noticed Gene Batlow, who's a playwright and historian from McDowell County. Gene's very passionate about her community and the story. We also heard from Doug Estep, who is the person basically working to help teach some of the teachers within the state of West Virginia about this Mine Wars history. What was it like to talk with folks who still live here, folks who've been telling these stories for many years? Was that important to you?
It was very important to connect with individuals that had to talk to individuals that had a connection to the story. And we really wanted to try to find those individuals, and they were kind of different connections to the story. Some obviously had spent a great part of their life learning more about the story and becoming, as with Chuck Keeney, you know, he's a historian and he teaches this as part of his, you know, as part of his livelihood in terms of as a historian. Doug Estep has been very much of a learning everything he can know about the story, and has become a valued asset in terms of helping to keep that story alive. And so, but, you know, I think there's a real connection, you know, having that connection to not only the story, but the place is very important. It's important to hear their story and hear it in their voice and to hear their understanding of that. And these were critical for us to help get closer to the story. And it was a real honor to be able to include some of them in the documentary itself. So for me, it helped, you know, bring me closer to the story and help brings a greater sense of who these people are to the audience, knowing that these people are so connected to what happened then.
And again, the documentary explains this story as a suppressed history. Obviously, there are some people, especially locally, who know a lot about this story, but many people across the country don't know a lot about the story. How important is this story to American history? Do others need to know more, you think?
I think understanding the labor struggle in America is incredibly important. It's, that effort to secure your rights in the workplace is something that has, you know, been an important part of American history and continues to do so, and continues to be so. Battle of Blair Mountain was the largest civil insurrection, you know, since the Civil War. So you have this specific singular event that happened, you know, in relationship to the struggles of these miners that is unique. You have this insurrection happening 300 miles from, you know, the nation's capital, and, you know, not just the fact that this happened, that somebody should know about it, but it's an important part of this legacy of the struggle, labor struggle in America. And, you know, as I said earlier, it's one of many instances of that effort, but I think it's a very important one. I think it plays, and I think it's important that people do know about this. I think it's, you know, to understand, you know, what people went through to try to secure better rights for themselves as workers in this country is a timeless story.
Randy, you've done so many of these projects like this. What surprised you while working on the Mine Wars documentary?
Every moment's a bit of a surprise on many different levels working on these films. It's a great pleasure to have an opportunity to get to learn more about our history and about the people that made our history. You know, I think in terms of, you know, what I took away from this, what really resonated quite strongly with me was the diversity that was found in these coal towns in southern West Virginia at a time when, in fact, sort of racial differences were hardening in the country. And, you know, I really took away, I think, a lot of hope and so on in seeing and understanding more about sort of that more unified struggle that happens. And so I looked at that as kind of one of the things that really sort of stuck with me and resonated quite strongly with me.
We've been listening to an interview with producer and director Randy McLowery, one of the producers of a PBS documentary called The Mine Wars. You can listen to more of this conversation with Randy on our website at wvpublic.org, and you can also find a link to the video of The Mine Wars, which is also available to watch for a limited time. Again, that's at wvpublic.org.
So as you may know, that music means it's time for What's in a Name. It's a segment that we do here on Inside Appalachia where we explore the stories behind Appalachian places. But this week, we wanted to do something just a little different. We wanted to learn the story behind the word that many people here in Appalachia have strong feelings about. It's the word redneck. Do you know what wearing a red bandana might have to do with the word? Well, we'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Now who's gonna speak up for the minor? Tell me who's gonna speak for the minor? When it comes down to the end, only you we depend. Thank God for the UNWA. Now who's gonna cry for the widow? Tell me who is gonna cry out for the widow? When it comes down to the end, on the Union we depend. Thank God for the UMWA. Now who's gonna stand up?
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest, the story behind the term redneck. One of the first times this term was recorded as being used was during the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain, which is perhaps the bloodiest chapter of the West Virginia Mine Wars. Striking miners supposedly put red bandanas around their necks to identify themselves as a sort of makeshift army. Historian Doug Estep says the only thing the coal companies gave them for free was a red bandana. The idea was to prevent shock so the miners would keep working in the event that they needed to wipe blood from an injury while working underground. Other miners already had one, so if they would have chosen anything else to identify union sympathizers, they would have had to go to the company store to buy it, which would likely raise a red flag to the owners. Also, Don Chafin, the sheriff of Logan County, who led men to fight against the striking miners in 1921, is reported to have said, "Kill all the rednecks you can." Well, when we first aired this story back in May 2015, one listener reached out on Twitter and said, "The word redneck preceded the mine wars. It started as a term for southern white field workers." While another one of you said, "Being a redneck has nothing to do with farming and everything to do with labor rights." And it turns out, the Battle of Blair Mountain wasn't the very first time the word redneck was used. Actually, in the 1600s, historians believe redneck was first used to refer to people in Scotland who wanted to belong to the Church of Scotland instead of the Church of England. The Scottish ministers were sometimes called rednecks because they supposedly signed manifestos using their own blood. Some even wore red cloth around their neck. Centuries later, the term was also used to describe poor white farmers in the southern United States. And if they're talking about a farmer's tan, that's a red tinted skin around a person's arms and neck after a long day of hard work outside, well, I'm not so sure I see that as an insult either. But the term redneck is a pretty common word, often said in an effort to insult someone. There are plenty of folks here in Appalachia that embrace the term redneck, and historian Chuck Keeney suspects even more will embrace the term after learning of the Appalachian history.
Understanding that the word redneck actually meant labor solidarity, and it meant diversity, as opposed to being a running joke or a reason for Jeff Foxworthy to make more money, you know, or a reason to belittle a region. And it is flipping those stereotypes and looking at the reality and the nuances of the history, which give us a clearer identity, and I think gives us a much more regional pride.
Oh, hard we may labor, but little we have. We are robbed of our rights, though we fought for the slave. Monopoly keeps grasping for more and still more. They will soon own the earth through the company store.
If you have another story about the term redneck or know of another place with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore, send us a tweet at InAppalachia and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're talking about America's largest armed insurrection since the Civil War, the West Virginia Mine Wars. As historian Chuck Keeney just mentioned, most West Virginians haven't been taught this story. Chuck's own great-grandfather, Frank Keeney, was involved in the Mine Wars, and as a child, even Chuck only learned about the Mine Wars when a family friend happened to mention it one day.
It was strange growing up with this history, because when I was first learning about it, this history was not being celebrated at all. So, I mean, there's enormous chunks of our history that are just missing. It's no wonder the people in the state have an identity crisis. We don't know our own story. If you don't know your own story, how can you determine what you are?
For the next part of our show, we're going to hear from people here in Appalachia who are helping to ensure that the history of West Virginia's mine wars isn't lost. In a little bit, we'll hear about a professor who's helping middle and high school teachers teach this history to their students. But first, we're going to visit the small community of Matewan in Mingo County, where the history is actually being used to help draw more visitors to the region. It's part of a larger project from the West Virginia Community Development Hub to help small towns in the state turn their town around and grow their local economy. For Matewan, using its history to help grow its struggling economy seemed like a perfect fit. Matewan has been doing reenactments of the notorious shootout between Baldwin Felt's detectives and Sid Hatfield's boys for about 20 years now. And that actual shootout took place May 20th, 1920. Donna Mae Paterino lives in nearby Kentucky, but has organized the Matewan reenactment for the past 15 years. She, like many involved in the project, think that heritage will play a key role in the revitalization efforts.
I didn't know what happened in Matewan in 1920, and we sure didn't talk about the Hatfield-McCoy feud because of the stereotype that it brought to this area through the media. Well, it's so important once you start researching the events of 1920 and in the early 1900s with the mining industry. It's so important that we teach our children today because they don't realize that they couldn't go down to Walmart and buy their favorite video game in 1920. They have no idea what it would have been like to live on company-owned property and have to shop at the company grocery store, go to the company doctor, go to the company school, and I feel like they need to know.
I interviewed Paterino back in 2014 during the annual Matewan reenactment.
This area along the Tug River in West Virginia and Kentucky was the front lines in the battle between the coal operators and United...
A crowd of about 100 people sat and stood under white canopies to watch and listen to the reenactment. It's unlikely that they found Matewan by mistake. The roads that lead to the small town with a population of less than 500 are riddled with switchbacks as they weave their way up to the edge of the mountains, far off the beaten path. The town sits at the foot of towering mountains at the foot of the Tug River Valley. Residents like Paterino say the future of the town's survival depends on them being able to draw more tourists down to visit.
And that's why we've got to focus on our history. That's bringing people here.
As I traveled along those mountainous roads, I couldn't help but notice the massive, beautiful homes, often with underground pools and slides, sitting beside the single-wide mobile homes. More than 20% of residents in Mingo County live below the poverty level, almost double the rate for West Virginia, according to the U.S. Census.
This looks like the town that time forgot. That was my first impression. But, you know, I've been here just a couple hours now only, but, you know, the people here are so warm and welcoming.
Claire Webb is an eighth grade history teacher at Wildwood Elementary in Jefferson County, where about 11% of residents live below the poverty level. That's half the percentage of Mingo County residents. She was visiting Matewan with Coal Country Tours to learn more about the mine wars. For Webb, the trip was humbling. She says Jefferson County is a different West Virginia than Mingo County.
So it's a very different climate. It's a very different environment socially, economically for sure. And so when I travel to this part of the state, I'm always struck by the differences in the eastern panhandle of the state versus the rest of the state. I'm humbled as a West Virginian by how we, you know, myself and Mingo Countyans, Wyoming Countyans, McDowell Countyans, we all hail from the same state, but we have such different views of our state. We have different challenges. We have a different perspective. We have different lives in West Virginia, and it's all about where you're from. And in these communities in the southern part of the state, in the coal fields, it really is, I do feel, sometimes an alternate universe. And I'm so grateful to my fellow West Virginians for their love for their state that allows them to live here and deal with these immense challenges that exist on a day-to-day basis with living in a southern coal field.
Again, that was Claire Webb, an 8th grade teacher from Jefferson County, West Virginia. She's now part of a growing number of 8th grade teachers who are teaching the history of the mine wars to their students. 8th graders in the Mountain State compete in what's called the Golden Horseshoe Contest. It's a test of how well youngsters know their West Virginia history. But the Mine Wars history isn't always a part of the curriculum. Like I mentioned earlier, some local folks have been telling this story for years, like native Doug Estep, who was also featured in the Mine Wars documentary. Back in 2016, Doug Estep began teaching a class that's intended to help teachers in West Virginia, or even across the country, share the Mine Wars story with their students. From the Inside Appalachia Archives, Liz McCormick has this story about the Mine Wars course.
This is part of who we are, and it's a history that's kind of been suppressed. It's been lost for a long time.
That's Doug Estep. He's an adjunct professor in Shepherd University's Lifelong Learning Program, which provides continuous education to teachers and community members. Estep is teaching a class on the West Virginia Mine Wars for the second time during the spring 2016 semester.
I grew up in Mingo County in a family of coal miners. My family didn't talk about it. My grandfather didn't talk about it. They would just kind of brush it off. When I would see little hints, I would see stories about tent colonies and strikes, and they just didn't want to talk about it. And, well, that was kind of the way people reacted all around the state.
The Mine Wars were a period of two decades at the beginning of the 20th century when coal miners and coal companies clashed in a series of brutal conflicts over labor conditions and unionization. And until the 1980s, major pieces of these historic clashes were left out of many West Virginia classrooms and textbooks. These are 8th graders at Wildwood Middle School in Jefferson County. Claire Webb, a history teacher, stands in front of her students pointing to a smart board that displays a map of the United States. Today, she's quizzing them on the names of each state capital.
Tallahassee. Audrey, come on up.
Webb has been teaching history for 6 years, but this will only be the second time she includes the Mine Wars into her lesson plans. Webb took Estep's class in the spring of 2015 when it was first offered. As a lifelong Eastern Panhandle resident, Webb wasn't familiar with the stories of the Southern West Virginia conflict, but when she found out, she insisted on sharing them with her students.
I did not realize how pivotal a role West Virginia played in the labor movement. And, you know, some of today's fair labor practices were implemented upon the literal backs of West Virginia miners. And so I did not understand how crucial some of these boycotts, the strikes, the uprisings, the Battle Blair Mountain, I did not realize how formational they were to today's labor practices.
Estep, the Shepherd professor, takes his classes of educators on a 3-day tour of southern West Virginia, provided through Coal Country Tours. Estep is also the owner of the touring company. 8th grade teacher Webb says actually visiting the region was the most beneficial part of the class and is even considering going back on the tour again.
My first experience was taking the tour with Coal Country Tours. We took the Mine Wars, the Coal Heritage Tour, and we visited about half a dozen spots around the southern part of the state that were relevant to our mining history. And prior to taking the tour, I hate to say it, but I honestly knew so little about this part of West Virginia history. And so taking the tour was eye-opening.
Coal Country Tours formed in 2010 when Estep took the first group through the coal fields. It's something he's passionate about, and Webb says it showed in the classroom.
It was so packed full of solid information. Doug is so knowledgeable about this subject and passionate. And so it was just an easy listening for 2 hours each week to all of his knowledge from, you know, the kinds of weapons that the Baldwin Felt detectives would bring, to the relationships between some of the townspeople, to, you know, the dates of the struggles and the uprisings, and exactly, you know, how things transpired in this part of the state.
Now, ESTEP is hoping to reach an even wider audience with his class. Students can meet physically on Shepherd's campus in Shepherdstown or in Martinsburg. But ESTEP has also created an online element so that folks can participate virtually via webcam in real time.
I've been trying to get the story out there for quite a while. When I got the chance to kind of roll it over into the lifelong learning program, that was even better because now instead of 3 days with a few hours on the bus, I've got 8 weeks, 2 hours every week to talk about this.
ESTEP will also be featured in the upcoming episode of the PBS documentary series, American Experience, called The Mine Wars. The premiere will no doubt bring more attention to West Virginia's critical role in the labor movement. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
That story originally aired last spring. Doug ESTEP says at this time, Shepherd University doesn't have a Mine Wars class scheduled, but they may in the fall. We've posted more information on our website at wvpublic.org. And if you'd like to learn more about the Mine Wars or visit some of the places where the history took place, there's also a Mine Wars Museum in downtown Matewan.
I'm Wilma Lee Steele, and I'm one of the board members for the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum. I was born on Buffalo Creek and grew up at Red Jacket, went to school at Matewan. So all of this history here is important to me.
Steele is a retired art teacher. Her passion is revitalizing her town and sharing the history behind the word redneck and the red bandanas.
The thing that I guess that gets me, that makes me want to do this and tell other people about this, is that all those immigrants from all these different countries, they didn't speak the same language. They did not have the same culture, and they were fighting each other and divided. But when they tied on these bandanas and marched, they became a brotherhood, you know. And one of the things that I love the best about the Union is that the Union was one of the early ones that says same pay for blacks and whites. It's pretty special.
She says she hopes the museum will become a place where people throughout the coal fields can come to reclaim their identity.
I think that we have a lot to say, and I think we're going to say it. We're going to tell our history, and we're going to come together as a community.
The Mine Wars Museum is closed for the winter, but it will open back up in April. During the season, they'll be open on Saturdays and Sundays from 12 noon until 7 in the evening. More information is on our website at wvpublic.org. There you can also hear our story from 2015 about the opening of the Mine Wars Museum.
You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, load another ton, or lift another finger till the Union we have won. Stand up.
I hope the story of the Mine Wars sends a message to people who might not understand who we are and how the struggles of miners and their families continue to this day. You know, I recently saw a post on Facebook about the PBS documentary from Tony Opegard. He's an attorney from Kentucky who's represented miners and their families for about 30 years. He also served as advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. When Tony learned about the Mine Wars documentary back in 2016, he shared, "Today, instead of subjudicating miners with scrip, gun thugs, and the help of the state police or National Guard, coal companies use lawyers and bankruptcy courts." Whether you're proud of this history or not, looking into the oppression of these people should give a better understanding of perhaps even your perceptions of West Virginians. If your family has mining roots, or if anyone in your family was involved in the West Virginia Mine Wars, we'd love to hear from you. So feel free to drop us a line. There's a place to comment at the bottom of our web posts, and you can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org or find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia, #MyAppalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WGBH in Boston and the American Experience series by PBS. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, the late Hazel Dickens, Hooray for the Riff Raff as heard on Mountain Stage, Time Erickson, and Riley Baugus from the album Blair Pathways. You also heard music by Alan Cathead Johnston, with help from Stacy Grubb from the soundtrack of the play, The Terror of the Tug. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. We want to say a big shout out to Suzanne Higgins, Chuck Roberts, and the rest of our video production crew for helping with this episode. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Patrick Stevens is our audio mixer. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. We'd love to hear from you, along with ways to reach us digitally. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.